Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I was quite naughty, but in an unpleasant and evil way.
So you were a bit Machiavellian?
Yeah, I was like a kind of evil character in Game of Thrones, who never gets found out.
This week on Walking the Dog, Raymond and I went for a stroll in South London with a very special guest, the wonderful author, historian, and of course, co-host of the hugely popular Restless History podcast, Tom Holland. And you know what? Because Tom Holland is such an endlessly fascinating man, who frankly we couldn't get enough of, we've decided to bring you our chat in two special parts. In the first episode, Tom talked to me a lot about his origin story and his very touching relationship with his childhood dog, Ben. And it was also so interesting to learn how his passion for history started at such a young age and to find out what really kick-started it all. Tom, I should also say, got on famously with Raymond, and hearing him call Raymond sweetheart might genuinely be one of the greatest moments I've certainly ever witnessed in history. I really hope you enjoy part one of my chat with Tom. Do remember to catch part two coming up later this week, and make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it. I'll stop talking now and hand over to the man himself. Here's Tom and Raymond. Come on, Raymond.
Oh, sweetheart.
What do you think, Tom, so far?
Did you see the Magic Roundabout? You must have seen the Magic Roundabout. I mean, he looks like Dougal. Was Dougal there?
Well, you're the history buff.
I mean, I don't think he's 100% an authentic representative of a dog species. But he's kind of got that move, hasn't he? Kind of caterpillar.
Let's walk up here. I was going to ask, if you don't mind, I couldn't help but notice when I heavily researched the coffee bar situation that there is a tea place there.
And there is, up in the stately home. Oh. Although it might not be open. It's quite variable.
Can we wander up that way, Tom?
Yeah.
I feel a stately home is exactly where I should be heading with
you. I mean, it's a stately home that's seen better days, I think it would be fair to say.
Well, it could be all of us.
But that's very Brockwell Park.
Well, Tom, I'm so thrilled to be with you. I'm with the very wonderful historian and author Tom Holland, and Raymond is here, and we're in Brockwell Park.
He's not, actually. He's hanging around the rubbish bin. No, now he's come.
Tom, what do you make of Raymond so far?
Well, I think he's very like Dougal on the Magic Roundabout. He's very handsome. You can't see his legs. He's a very distinctive-looking dog.
He is, isn't he?
Adorable.
And I was saying
I love his tail.
Yeah.
Kind of goes in all kinds of directions.
He's got quite a...
Does he wag it?
Oh, when he gets excited. Well, and you'll
I hope that at some point in this walk, I will get to see him wag his tail.
You can. He sort of twerks, really.
He does a bit, yeah. I can imagine that. But, I mean, it's kind of... He looks like a push-me-pull-you, because it looks like he's got his head as his back as well.
Come on, show Tom how you wag your tail. Obviously got lots I want to talk to you about, because I'm a huge fan of your podcast, The Rest Is History, along with the rest of the world. And I thought you were going to get on with Raymond, because he's got something of the... historian energy about him.
In what way?
Well,
I mean, lots of historians are very lazy.
How dare you, Tom? You only just met him.
Well, I know. I'm saying he's full of energy. So I'm not saying, you know.
I tell you why. Because he's very thoughtful and reflective. And he's also quite curious about the world.
Right, yes. So he's kind of interesting smells.
He's quite considered. As well.
He doesn't roll in shite or anything.
No.
Because he's got quite a lot of fur, hasn't he? That would not be pleasant.
Do you know what? He's a bit of an old school gent, Raymond.
Is he?
And he looks at other dogs sort of rolling around and as if they're animals, frankly.
Which I suppose they are.
Exactly. Searching and fearing.
To be fair.
So, Tom, you haven't brought a dog with you because you don't have a dog.
I don't have a dog. I had dogs when I was a child, but that was because I grew up in the country. And We've just never had dogs in living in London. We've got two cats. Initially, we didn't have cat because I was very allergic to them. And then we got adopted by an absolutely monstrous black stray. And this was in Holloway, so we called him Stanley. And we adored him so much. And it was kind of what made me think that it would be good to have children. We lavished all our parental affection on Stanley, who in so many ways was a cat that did not really repay our affection, it would be fair to say. And then we got two kittens, and just because I'm really arsy, we called them Harold and Edith, after Harold Godwinson, who died at the Battle of Hastings, and his sister Edith. And Harold ran away. He didn't die. He got picked up by somebody else, and he'd been chipped. But there were two children who adored him so much we couldn't bear to take him back. So we got another kitten whom we called Tosti. So Tosti was Harold's younger brother. So we've got Edith and Tosti, and Edith is now, she's going to be 18 in April.
Wow!
So she's a very, very elderly lady, and she's really living her best life. Even at this venerable age. But obviously, you can't take her for walks in parks.
I would say that the reason I think you're going to get along with Raymond is because he's got quite cat-like qualities.
He has quite, yeah. I mean, he's not sitting on a cushion, which is basically what Edith does all day now.
Not right now.
But does he? He has been known to.
I treat him very much, because his breed was originally from the... Oh, there's some trouble up there, Tom. What are you like when it all kicks off?
I run away. That's the lesson of history. That's why it's worth studying. You know what to do. This is a great park for
it's
dog
beautiful.
Walkers.
It's beautiful. Ray's met
someone. And it's a brilliant way to make friends.
Come on, Ray.
So whenever you bring a dog here, you always make friends. It's such an icebreaker.
And so when you were growing up, Tom, let's go back to your childhood, because... You did, as you said, you had a dog. Am I right in thinking you had a dandy Dimon?
Yeah, we did. So our first dog was a bearded collie, who was called Ben, who just was one of those pets that accompany, you know, when they accompany children through their lives. And when he died, it was like childhood was over. So he's the one who is kind of centremost in my heart. But then my parents have always had dogs. So they've still got one now.
And was he like your... I've heard you talking about Lord Byron's dog, who's obviously
Boson, yes.
Famously memorialised.
Yes, his funerary urn is at Newstead Abbey.
And it's... What does it say, Tom? It's something like all the virtues of men and none of the vices.
Yes. But he had rabies. Boson, not Byron. Byron tended him, wiping away the froth from his jaws.
So the bearded collie, and what was the bearded collie called again?
Ben.
Ben. How lovely, and you did form a real attachment to Ben.
Oh, I love Ben. I mean, we all love Ben. Our house is still full of pictures of him.
Aww.
Photos, paintings, drawings of him. We
paintings.
Loved him. Yeah.
And this was growing up in, was it
So it was a village outside Salisbury, and we lived in a cottage called a yew tree cottage because it had a yew tree. And the yew tree, the branches hung over the road. So it leaned over the fence and hung over the road. And whenever a bus came by, the top of the bus would scrape the yew tree branches. And Ben would run round and round the garden for about 20 times, barking his head off. And we would just scream, Ben, but with no expectation that he would stop running around barking. And it just became kind of part of the background noise. So... Sadie, my wife, when she first came to stay with us, she was stunned that this dog was just running around howling. We would just shout Ben and nothing would be done.
So it must have felt like a real sense of part of your childhood had gone when
completely.
Ben went.
And I feel, and this is why I feel sad at how old Edith is, because I know when she dies that it will be like that for my daughters.
Well, they say it's that first very difficult
bereavement
lesson,
experience.
Isn't it? And one of life's most inconvenient truths,
yeah.
I suppose. Unless you sublet it out to Disney and make them watch yes. The Lion King.
Yes. Bambi.
Tell me also, did you have a dandy Dimmin then?
Is it? Yeah, called Jake. Jakey. And dandy Dimmins are, I'm sure, I mean, you know, as a dog person, you'll know all this. But they're very exclusive. And they have a tremendous pedigree. So they come with a family tree. And they have a little top knot. And I think they're named after a character in a Walter Scott novel. And he was a very adorable dog, but he had a bad back. I think dandy Dimmins have bad backs. So he was less mobile than, say, Ben.
Yeah.
So Jakey would not run around the garden shouting at buses. That was not his vibe at all.
They're really, they're incredibly unusual, as you say, aren't they? I think you rarely see them. Whenever I see one, I'm really excited.
Yeah, they're very unusual, as actually are bearded collies. So bearded collies aren't that common either.
So I'm interested to know a bit more about what life was like growing up for you. You were out near sort of Salisbury, as you say.
Yeah.
And sounds quite an idyllic childhood.
Yeah, it was. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful childhood.
And it was you and your mum. Was your dad a solicitor or something?
Yes. And my mother was an occupational therapist.
And your brother, James...
So this was a village called Broadchalk, where Cecil Beaton lived. So Greta Garbo would come there. And we had the house next door to it. So it was this gorgeous, massive Queen Anne house, and had it this huge... I mean, it wasn't really a garden, it was grounds. And we would just kick a ball over, or hit a ball over, and then we'd have an excuse to go and roam around. So it was like Peter Rabbit in Mr. McGregor's garden. It was great.
How incredible, Tom.
Yeah.
To have that. What, next door neighbours?
Yeah, I know.
And so did you see sort of glamorous people coming and going?
No, never saw them. No, I mean, we never... I think we saw Cecil Beaton very, very rarely.
Can I just say that's a great quote? I mean, the thing is, I'd love you to have said that as a child, we see Cecil Beaton so rarely, that's the problem.
I didn't mean socially, one sees Cecil. But I mean, literally, he barely ever came out.
So, it was you, are we allowed to name your mum and dad?
Yeah, Jans and Martin.
Jans and Martin, and James.
Yeah.
And Tom.
Yeah.
I read somewhere, I don't know if it was you that said this, that it was kind of almost like an Edwardian childhood.
No, it was quite a 70s childhood, because it was in the 70s. I mean, it was lots of space hoppers and rallies and all that kind of thing. I mean, it was very, very 70s. And lots of time spent in multi-storey car parks. So there was definitely...
I just hear Yew Tree Cottage and I get excited. Londoner.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there was an element of that. And the whole going around, as you know, the vegetable garden of a stately, of an enormous Queen Anne house. I mean, that was quite Edwardian. It was very, very Beatrix Potter. But looking back, it was a very 70s. Very 70s upbringing.
And were you quite a kind of studious and quiet child?
I was very bookish. I basically found things in the past a lot more interesting than things in the present. So I loved dinosaurs, and I loved them with an intensity that I find very, very hard to convey as an adult. I would have given anything to have seen a dinosaur. And I found, life in the 1970s, immense frustration that it wasn't the Mesozoic. And I would say that the interest in dinosaurs then seamlessly moved on to the Romans and then Middle Ages. And there was never a time where I wasn't more interested in the past. There wasn't that much you could do to engage with the past beyond having books and reading about them. There wasn't a lot else you could do. I mean, you know, there might be, I don't know, plastic models or something, but there's not much you can do with plastic models. So I looking back at it, I realised that I spent a lot of time, not exactly a fantasy world, but a world in which everything seemed more vivid in my imaginings. And so that's why I would, that's why I was bookish. Because I a good history book or a good book about dinosaurs when I was even younger, I mean, it would transport me in a way that very few things in the real world would, which is kind of, I don't know whether it's a, whether that's a terrible thing when I look back or not.
I've always been interested in the that sort of childhood fascination with dinosaurs, and I've read different theories on that. There was one thing I read once, I think it was some sort of Jungian practitioner who said and had said something about how it's the child, it's kind of the child making sense of the world because they're surrounded by all these big unfathomable creatures.
You see, was it, I
don't know, but do you think kids, mythical, but
it's precisely because it's not mythical, actually.
Yeah, it's real.
They were real. So the fact that they were real was a crucial part of the appeal. The fact that these extraordinary creatures had existed, but also the impossibility ever of seeing them. So I don't quite know what a... Maybe it's more a Freudian thing, that you want something that you can't have. You know it was there, but it no longer is. I can imagine psychotherapists having a field day with that. But I think it's also that when you're very young, they just seem impossibly fierce and exciting and terrifying, but safely extinct. So the fact that they are, that you can't see them, is what enables you, gives you a license to be frightened by them. I think also because there was no CGI, because they were very rarely on TV, there just wasn't the kind of the array of commercially driven dinosaur themed products that there are now.
Mm.
You had to kind of collect such opportunities to gawp at dinosaurs as you could. So a book would be a magical thing. If there was a new dinosaur book, it would be a magical thing, and I would read over and over and over again.
Little Tom Holland sitting at home saying, new dinosaur book just dropped.
They give me a Proustian rush. I still have them, the ones that I have. So they're in the attic of my parents' house. So if I look at them, they instantly take me back. There's actually a website that's devoted to old dinosaur books, and I have them all. And I just kind of look at them, and it's this, as I say, this kind of Proustian rush. And so I then seamlessly moved on to Romans and Greeks. So the books of Greek myths, my grandmother had a massive collection of, they must have been Edwardian books, I guess, about the world mythologies, and they had tremendous illustrations. They were all kind of Pre-Raphaelite paintings and sculptures and things. But again, they were just so exciting to look at. And then there were the ones kind of more tailored for children. I have them as well. But there was also a book, it was called The Roman Army, and it was written by the same bloke who illustrated it, a man called Peter Connolly. And on the cover, it had Julius Caesar's greatest victory, where he was besieging a Gallic army, and then another Gallic army came to relieve it. So he was being attacked on both sides. And on the cover, it showed massive great battle. There was kind of blood everywhere. And it was like an illustration of a sauropod being devoured by an allosaur or something. And it obviously just appealed to the kind of horrible...
boy.
Horrible kind of little boy thing, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Tom, what would you like to drink?
I would like a hot chocolate, please.
What a brilliant idea.
I've had about 5 cups of tea already.
2 hot chocolates, no marshmallows and cream.
Okay, 2 hot chocolates.
No, you're going for hot chocolate?
Yeah. Hello.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Just getting some hot chocolates.
And could I have a pastel de nata as well? Thank you.
Excuse my ignorance. That reminds me of like those Portuguese custard tart. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Do you know what? Tom.
You're going to go for that as well?
Would you mind if I copied
no,
you?
Go for it.
Can I have a pastel de nata as well? 2 of those. 2 plates would be great. I really like you, Tom, but I think it's quite early to share plates, don't you? And I want to respect Mrs. Tom, a.k.a. Sadie.
Mm. If you wouldn't mind. She wouldn't mind at all.
Come on, Ray. I love coming to this area. My grandmother used to live around here.
Mm. It's a wonderful park. It disgraced itself in the pandemic.
Did it? Why?
It was the first it was the first park to be shut down for misbehaviour. You know, they'd all rushed around putting tape on benches so that no one could sit down. And everyone ignored it. And there were kind of massive parties going on. So they shut it down. We were all put on the naughty step. And I think it was the first park in the whole of Britain to have misbehaved so badly. I just felt this great pride in Brixton. yet again.
Should we sit here and finish our tarts, Tom? Mm. We don't want to be wandering around holding our plates with our tarts on like it's the ambassador's reception.
We could multitask.
I'm getting a really strong picture of your childhood and bookish Tom.
Mm-hmm.
With his dinosaur books.
Yeah.
And his books on ancient Rome.
Yeah.
And I bet you were quite a well-behaved kid, weren't you?
I was quite well-behaved, yeah. I'm not one of life's natural rebels. No.
What about James, your brother? Because normally it's...
He'd always get in trouble much more than me. I was kind of quite evil. You know, I might occasionally blame him. And because my reputation was a good one, I'd always get away with it. So I was quite a kind of unpleasant... You know, I was quite naughty, but in an unpleasant and evil way.
So you were a bit Machiavellian.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like a kind of evil character in Game of Thrones who never gets found out. I was like Littlefinger.
Yes.
I mean, not 100%, I hasten to add, but...
Well, I always used to have, with my late sister, we used to have a game when we were growing up. Similar to you and James, probably. There were two of us, and I was Naughty Spice, I suppose. I was the James, and she was Tom. And she used to have a brilliant thing, that whenever she met someone, she had three categories she put people into, and she said... She used to say, some people are kings, and kings can't get along with other kings. So she said everyone was either a king or a courtier. And then I remember meeting someone once. I said, what are they? And she went, oh, that's a poisoner.
Oh, right, yes.
And the poisoner category...
I mean, I don't want to say that I was a poisoner. I mean, I got on. My brother and I adored each other. We had a wonderful, wonderful childhood.
No, but
We got on with each other so well. And we still do. And I mean, I know sometimes siblings cannot get on. Always get on well, but we always got on well, and my occasional forays into Machiavellian evil were very limited.
I suspect you tried to be Machiavellian, but you probably weren't.
I didn't
weren't.
Try, I was.
What sort of things would it be? Just
oh, you know, I'd do something, my mother would get cross, I would say it was him, and I would look so innocent that he'd then get in trouble for denying it. I mean, oh, everyone's had that, surely. Or am I betraying utter depths of depravity? Maybe he's listening to this and he'll realise that it was all me and he'll never speak to me again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I read you said something about your dad once, which I found really telling and quite interesting, which was that he was a bit of a sort of TV refusenik in some ways, and that...
He wouldn't allow us to watch ITV or The Generation Game, or, despite being a massive football fan, Match of the Day. So there were all kind of weird things that he... you know, he'd taken against. So I still feel a bit guilty every time I watch ITV. And I still feel quite guilty watching Match of the Day. So it's kind of lingering aftershock.
Well, that's Orcs, isn't it? Considering yeah. who owns our company.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah,
sorry,
it is.
Gary,
yeah.
if you're listening, yeah. can I say Tom is fine.
Yeah, but that was long before Gary was on it. So it must have been Jimmy Hill. He had weird things he took against. So, yeah. Other things he took against was basically anywhere foreign. So we never went abroad ever. I remember there was this... So I said there were no programmes about dinosaurs, ever. Mm. But there was this one series, it was an Open University series called For the Ark, and I must have been about six, but I would watch it without understanding almost anything in it. But then they had a programme about dinosaurs, which came from this town called Dinosaur, which was in America, next to a national park where there were lots of dinosaur bones. And the way they shot it, it made it look as though everywhere was about dinosaurs. So there'd be... I imagine there being dinosaur restaurants and dinosaur parks and dinosaur shops, and it would all just be brilliant. And I begged and begged my parents, could we go to Dinosaur? But it was in America, so there's no way we're going to go to America. I mean, so my father didn't like America either. So that was also on his list of things he didn't like. And then just before my first daughter was born, I thought this is going to be my last chance for ages to go on a trip, so I'm going to go to Dinosaur, and I went with my oldest friend, and we drove all the way there. It was miles and miles and miles, and these signs would start appearing saying 100 miles to Dinosaur, 50 miles to Dinosaur, you are only 20 miles from Dinosaur, yes folks, it's only 3 miles to Dinosaur. We arrived at Dinosaur, there was nothing there. It was a crossroads with a stegosaur, a model of a stegosaur that had been vandalised. They'd knocked its head off, and I just felt this. I mean, I imagine if I'd taken made my father go there, he would have hated it. I was so relieved. So, in lots of ways, he was right in his determination not to go anywhere that wasn't, yeah. didn't have really cold seas.
Well, certainly he'd realised that pre-Google, you've got to do your research.
He's never had an email. He's never had an email address.
Your dad?
Yeah. He's never had a mobile phone. I mean, he's a very distinctive man.
I kind of love that in a way.
Whereas my mother's tremendously game.
Really?
Yeah. She's got an iPad and all kinds of things. She can do it all.
Do you think, Tom, as you get older, you kind of look back on some of the stuff your parents said and you think, oh, yeah, maybe they were right about that?
Well, they were... are still very loving, very kind, never had any doubt that they, you know, that we were put first. So in that sense, absolutely, I mean, they're completely my role models. I mean, in other senses, on the whole never watching ITV thing, I mean, less so. And now I have to say, I mean, they watch ITV very happily. They watch ITV a lot.
Oh, well, they're sitting there watching Dancing on Ice. Can't get enough of it.
No, they wouldn't watch celebrities doing...
Wouldn't they?
No, that would...
Would they watch any reality TV?
No. I mean, no.
Can you imagine if you...
The whole Celebrities on Ice thing. I mean, that is not... That's not their bag.
You know what I'd love? I'd love to sneak round to your house and find your dad on an iPad watching Dancing on Ice. We'd catch him.
You'd never catch him. You'd never catch him.
So, and you were, as you said, you were very studious and passionate about dinosaurs and passionate about specifically Roman history.
Well, all history. I mean, the Greeks and the Romans were my gateway drug, but I loved it all. I mean, and it's kind of a limitless source of fascination. Mm. So it was a great thing to get into.
And when you were at school, was it obvious that... Were you very good at history?
Yes, I was very good at history.
Really?
Yeah, it was the one thing I was good at.
But interestingly, as we know, or as many people may know, you ultimately you went on to read English at university.
I did.
But you were presumably, you were a fairly straight A student.
Yeah. Modest. Yeah, I was.
You were kind of the dream child, really.
No, I think I was more awkward than that.
In what way?
I think there were lots of things I wasn't good at. I had good friends, but there were lots of people who I found it hard to get on with. My brother has an incredible ability. I mean, he has a genius for getting on with all kinds of people. And I felt I closed myself off against the kind of experiences that perhaps I should have had. I didn't perhaps just as a young child play, or as a teenager kind of hang out to quite the degree that I sometimes think I should have done.
It's that sort of abandon that children have, you know, that
so we had cousins, and when they came to stay with us, or we went to stay with them, then it was like, it was kind of magical. It was just kind of magical. Sense that everything was great. Everything was full of adventure and fun and excitement. So I remember that, but I somehow with other friends, kind of less so. And I think it may be because we weren't in a town, and so therefore it was quite difficult to just meet up casually, because you always had to kind of arrange, you'd go on the bus or get your parents to drive you or something. And I look at my daughters, and they, you know, they live in London and they can just go anywhere, and it's really easy for them. So I think maybe that was it. But again, having said that, it didn't seem to worry my brother at all. He managed to handle it much better than me.
I wonder if, in some ways, that passion that you had, you obviously got really, was so intensely fascinated. You had this kind of interior world, really, didn't you?
The thing is, I mean, that it's hard for anyone under the age of what, 40? To imagine the potential for boredom that growing up in the 70s, you could be so bored. I think it's impossible now to be bored. Everyone's got phones. There's always something you can do.
But then do you look back at your dad saying, for example, slightly restricting your access to TV, for example?
He never stopped us watching it. It wasn't like that. It wasn't. He never said you can't watch it. It was just he would make it clear that he didn't approve. You know, he despised people who watched it. I think it was that. I didn't want.
But that's quite a heavy incentive not to watch it, because kids want their parents' approval. So
yes,
no, I'm not acting like he was like some Mr. Murdstone or something. It's no. It's just that I know there are things that my parents would say, and it wasn't you can't do this, but just from the fact that they didn't approve of it, that would make me think, oh, okay, that's not in our family script, or maybe I won't do that. What I'm saying is, would you have been as brilliant if you'd have had access to all of that?
It's not a question of being brilliant. It's a question of imagining things vividly. And it's hard for me to tell, because I think that your imaginings have an intensity as a child. Mm. And perhaps, you know, into early adulthood, that they don't have as you get older. Your dreams and your imaginings are less vivid. You know, your earliest experiences, perhaps because you're experiencing them the first time, are always more vivid. But I'm sure that was turbocharged by the fact that, you know, there wasn't really much to see on TV. There weren't iPads. There weren't phones. So in a way, you had to make your own entertainment.
You went to... Cambridge you went to.
Yeah.
And you read English.
Yeah.
Were your parents really proud when you got in? Or was it kind of on the cards, really? Because you had...
I'm sure they were. I mean, they must have been. But I never felt I had to do it because they would be disappointed if I didn't get it. I always had the utter confidence that no matter what I did or if I messed things up or whatever, they would still absolutely love me. I mean, I never had any doubt on that score. I never felt any pressure from them, you know, that there were things I had to do to impress them or anything. I always felt that they would love me, didn't matter.
I love the Hollands.
They're wonderful parents. And I mean, I've made my father sound eccentric, and like looking back, I think he is quite eccentric.
I like people like that.
I mean, I never thought of him as being eccentric when I was growing up. I mean, he was always the absolute standard of what a father should be.
I think he sounds like he just had integrity, because I like people that...
He does have integrity. He absolutely has integrity.
You know, think, well, these are my beliefs, and this is how I'm going to live my life.
But he's also... I mean, he was also a very gentle person, and I think quite a... very funny, but shy as well.
See, you're very funny, Tom, and that comes over a lot in your Rest Is History podcast, because obviously you're a great double act. So was that humour something... Did you laugh a lot at home?
Yeah. Yeah, yes, I suppose so.
And when you went to Cambridge, you did English, as we say, and you did quite well, didn't you?
Yeah.
What did you get, Tom?
I got double first.
Again, I imagine that was probably predicted from... The tutors probably loved you. What's it like to be so good at everything?
I'm not good at everything. I mean, I'm absolutely not good at everything.
What are you not good at?
Well, I've said, I mean, I'm not good at... I think I'm better, but I'm not good at... we've got a friend who's staying with us at the moment, Laura, who... has an absolute genius for just, you know, you want to go somewhere, she knows where you should go. You want a great time, she can just organise it. I can never do that. It's an absolute failing that if I do organise something, there'll be something wrong with it. You know, I don't know, I'll forget something, or it will have shut, or whatever. It's a kind of talent. For living well, for living kind of joyously. And I, you know, a talent for joy is maybe something that I've really had to kind of work at.
A sort of spontaneity and...
Yeah.
Embracing your...
Well, you see, I think you can be...
Heart.
I think you can be too bookish that in a way... kind of just thinking, oh, I'll just go with it. I'll just go with, you know, where things... So I do try and do that. So I tell you another thing, cooking. So my daughters, they can just open the fridge. You know, there's all kinds of rubbish there. And they can just put it together and it's always amazing. And I can never do that. I get kind of tense about recipes and things. I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but there's a kind of genius. If I mean, I'm loads of people listening to this, I'm sure, are just brilliant at rustling things up with stuff that's in a fridge. But if you don't have that talent...
I know, but you
know
what?
It's something, you know, that I really envy. And I kind of... And it's one of the great things about being a parent is when you see your children do things that you can't
Tom,
do.
Oh, look.
What's happened? Oh, no. Your hot chocolate's leaking.
I spilt hot chocolate all over myself.
No.
See, I've got rid of it now. One of my skills, if you're interested, is getting stains out of things.
Chocolate.
No, it's getting stains out of things.
You see, I wouldn't have that either.
So you got your double first from Cambridge, and you had a great time there, I presume.
I did, yes, I did.
And did you sort of feel you came out of your shell a bit? Sort of socially, because...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And did you meet your...
I did.
I met
my wife
there.
There. Yes, I did.
What happened when you first met her?
So she was... we met on the first day that we were at Cambridge. And she was in a room, two rooms down. No, sorry, she was a floor above, but she was in the same block. And she introduced herself as Sadie. She's a distinctive name. And so I said, oh, sexy Sadie. And instead of giving me a slap, she recognised the allusion to the White Album. And so essentially that was the first thing we ever talked about. And the Beatles remain a bond to this day.
That was about, wasn't that song about one of the...
It's about the Maharishi.
Yeah, it's about the Maharishi.
Yeah. John Lennon came back from Rishikesh and he'd gone there and decided that he was all a fraud. So, yes, it's about him being a fraud. But he didn't want to make it explicit that it was about the Maharishi, so he disguised it.
Was there
but then
a part...
made, went around and told everyone, which is very John Lennon.
Was there a part of you when she got that reference? There was nice those moments where you feel, oh, yeah, OK, we're on the same page.
Yeah, exactly. We were best friends. It was kind of very... Well, it's not like one day, because on one day they meet on the last day, don't they? But obviously, I'm slightly less eligible than Dexter.
So you guys met and you were friends.
Yeah, and then she got a grant to go and study film at Stanford in California. And the thought of her going away for a year suddenly shocked us both into thinking, let's get this together. So we did. And the rest is history.
And what did she make of you when she first saw you?
I think she probably thought I was a bit of an arse.
I did read her say somewhere that you were wearing espadrilles when you first met. And
yeah,
she wore...
it was all kind of, you know, awful mid-80s student.
Slightly wham.
All that kind of, yes. Terrible hair.
You're the Andrew Ridgeley of Cambridge.
Yeah, what does that make Dominic? George Michael? I don't think so.
I really hope you enjoyed part one of my chat with Tom Holland from The Rest Is History. As I said, he was such a fantastic guest. We're extending our chat into a second episode. If you're listening to this on the day of release, you can hear part two on Thursday. And make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.